The name of our podcast, Tech Sequences, is really a mashup of two words, technology and consequences. We are fascinated by the consequences, intended or unintended, of the internet and related technologies for the way we live, play, and work. We are your hosts, Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. We started our careers at the dawn of the internet and have been friends, colleagues, and comrades in arms for the better part of 20 years. In this podcast, we examine the impact internet-related technologies have made or may make in our lives. I'm Alexa Rod.
And I'm Leslie Daigle.
And this is Tech Sequences. In today's episode, we focus on one of the technologies used in the fight against the COVID-19 pandemic, which has garnered attention, angst, and hope, contact tracing applications. But to understand contact tracing applications, you first have to understand how contact tracing has traditionally been done. Part of the process of controlling the spread of communicable diseases involves identifying and tracking individuals who have been in prolonged contact with an infected person. This has to be done quickly and with enough accuracy to triangulate, isolate, and hopefully treat those potentially exposed in order to slow the spread of the disease to the rest of the population. The process called contact tracing is a vital and proven strategy to control outbreaks ranging from HIV to SARS to Ebola. For all of its effectiveness, contact tracing is still a labor-intensive process of interviews and detailed detective work and coordinated communication. But is there a better, faster, cheaper solution? Can technology come to our aid? And if so, what are the consequences? Up until a few months ago, few people were familiar with contact tracing apps. But today, governments and private enterprises are working on or have already launched contact tracing apps that leverage the ubiquity of mobile devices and built-in features such as Bluetooth to facilitate the time-consuming data collection aspects of traditional contact tracing processes. To date, more than 24 countries have released their own contact tracing apps. In addition, as early as April of this year, Google and Apple announced an unprecedented collaboration to launch a solution that includes application programming interfaces, APIs, and updates to operating system level technology to assist in enabling contact tracing. Our guest today is Patrick Howell O'Neill. He is a cybersecurity journalist focused on topics ranging from national security to personal privacy. He is also a contributor and writer for MIT Technology Review and is part of an ongoing effort to track and document 30 and counting contact tracing apps. Hi, Patrick. Welcome to Tech Sequences.
Thank you for having me.
Wow, and I'm really impressed, Alexa, that you got through all that and said contact tracing so clearly every single time. I'm sure I could not have managed that.
You just watch.
So Patrick, you and two other colleagues from MIT Technology Review decided to keep a running inventory of contact tracing apps, their features and policies and use. Why?
As the pandemic was ramping up and authorities around the world and people around the world were trying to wrestle with how to approach this problem on many different levels, contact tracing, digital contact tracing specifically, came up as one part of a larger solution. And suddenly governments and schools and private companies were all coming up with a bunch of apps and protocols and APIs, et cetera, just ideas that would contribute to digital contact tracing apps. And it became impossible to understand what all the apps were, how they worked, if they worked, what they did with your privacy, what they did with your data. There were so many questions, and you know, we were trying to be on the contact tracing app beat. We were trying to understand it. We were finding it pretty impossible to do. And we realized we kind of had to start from the 30,000 foot view and just get a holistic view, a global view. And even that, though, proved too much, because we found hundreds of efforts of varying kind of significance. You know, whether it's kind of an academic just releasing a paper saying, wouldn't this be a good idea? That kind of counts as a protocol. Or a government saying, this is what we're doing. Like, the range is pretty enormous. So we decided to make sure our scope was focused with the idea being, let's make sure that we interrogate these apps that people will actually use, that will actually impact people. So you'll notice our database is exclusively apps with national backing, national government backing. And it's helped us to, you know, to some extent to understand the landscape that was previously pretty impossible to, for us at least, to get our head around.
So there are a number of things that you elected to track in terms of capturing data about all these different apps. So things like launch during development, number of users, a penetration rate, but also characteristics such as voluntary or not, anonymized or not, centralized or decentralized. Can you tell us a little bit more about what were the characteristics you thought were important to capture and why?
Yeah, it's funny. It's like a little bit of, a behind the scenes and how we tried to make this, you know, a holistic, you know, collection of data, but also something that people would be able to read and take something away from. If you look at the front end on our website, we just have five categories, five stars, little explanations for those categories, just trying to show people, this is the app in your country, this is what it does. If you go into our the Google Doc that you're looking at now, that has a little more information. We've elected not to put all of that on the front end until we can kind of figure out a better way to present it so people can digest it. We decided these, just to talk about the five that we put on the front end first, we decided after looking at the way that different civil liberties organizations around the world were trying to understand these apps, we decided that that was a useful lens, at least to start to understand these apps. So the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, and then Access Now, which is a similar, more global, more maybe more European focused organization, both put out reports within a pretty close time frame, I think in February or March, saying that these are the attributes, they each had varying attributes that they believed would be a good way that apps like these could go forward, could be effective, and could still respect civil liberties. So, you know, they talked about, is it voluntary? They talked about who can access the data. They talked about, does the data live forever? Is there a sunset clause? Is there, you know, transparency in the effort? They talked about a lot of different things. We tried to boil it down. I mean, some of these papers were dozens of pages long, but what we're trying to do while linking to those efforts is boil it down so that people can begin, take their first step to understand this on a wide scale. So we went with, you know, is it voluntary? You know, are there limitations on how the data gets used? Does the data get destroyed? Is data collection minimized? And is the effort transparent? Are five ways, just from a civil liberties and privacy point of view, that we think are important. But I think also one thing that probably is our fault for not communicating this well enough, although we definitely did say it explicitly in the article, this is not a recommendation article. This isn't us saying it's five stars, you better download it, or it's four stars, definitely don't download it. It's us arming people with information so that they can make the decision in their context, because it's different from country to country. And we found that there was no information to be armed with prior to this, or it was very difficult and you couldn't expect the everyday person to do that. So that was our goal. And you know, the exact attributes, we can talk a little bit more about that if you want, but I think the idea was basically saying, are there, you know, guidelines and guardrails here, or is this just something that is kind of flying by the seat of its pants with no rules?
I'm glad you mentioned that, because that is important, and we'll probably get back to it in terms of what users should take away from this. But let's step back a little bit. Are these apps even effective in terms of contact tracing? The Oxford University apparently did a study and found that you almost need to have a 60% penetration in the population so that the information from these apps is actually effective in identifying and triangulating. And I think in the research that you did, Australia, for example, has like 21% penetration. So that's still a major gap. The other thing in terms of effectiveness is, do they account for all sorts of, you know, contamination? Let's say I go, I'm infected, I go to a restaurant, opened the door handle, and 2 minutes later, and I leave, so there's no Bluetooth. Somebody else comes in, touches that door handle, and now their hands are contaminated? Does the app address those?
So there's a lot to unpack there. I'm going to start with the Oxford research because it's right now it's the thing that is very much stuck on my brain. So you just brought up that what they said was, and I'm going to paraphrase kind of what you said, but you need 60% adoption rate of these apps to be effective. And that's something that's been repeated all over the place. And it's not actually not what the research says. The research says that at 60% adoption, the apps would stop the pandemic, would bring the reproduction number under one. And then even with lower numbers of apps users, there would still be, it would still be effective. There would still be a reduction in coronavirus cases and deaths. And part of the reason why this has been, on my brain is I talked to the lead researcher last week about it, Christoph Fraser, the lead researcher on this paper. And he was talking frustratedly about how difficult it is to control the media narrative, was his phrase. And, you know, it's a tricky thing. Like, it's totally understandable that people are trying to figure out how do you judge the success of this, because that's the question you have to ask in order to improve and learn lessons. So I think it's a totally understandable question to ask, but I think this 60% number has taken on a life of its own. And it's just not, I don't think, what the Oxford folks were saying at all. I think that they don't have, like, there is no number where if we get to this number, then that's where effectiveness starts. Effectiveness accrues as more people adopt. And they're doing more research on this, and I'm pretty sure actually later this week they're going to be coming up with some follow-up research. But nevertheless, adoption is an important question. And you are right to say that adoption has not, you know, even if 60% isn't some magical threshold, it would be great if it got to 60% in terms of effectiveness. That would really be a powerful tool, and it hasn't done that yet. And I see, just to take an America-centric point of view, I see no sign that that's going to happen in the U.S. for any of these apps. I don't have a fortune-telling hat, but that's just, all signs point to that not happening.
I want to just drill down a little bit into that number, because I mean, it seems to me that in terms of app support for contact tracing, there's at least two different ways this can go. It can be either because two people have the same app and they detect that they're close to each other. And if one of them is sick, then automatically, you know, the other one should be considered for isolation, or at least to see if they, to be warned that they may have caught the disease. Another is just simply tracking location, simple old-fashioned location tracker. So that even if somebody becomes sick in a particular location in a particular time frame, you can know of the people who were using the contact tracing app, you can know who was in the vicinity around that time and may or may not have been exposed to the virus. I think that the different approaches speak a little bit to the question of how many deployments or how much penetration of deployment do you need before you get success for some definition of success, and also has a lot of implications in terms of privacy concerns, right? And normally we're very averse to letting people know exactly where we've been, but COVID-19 pandemic has turned the world on its head. And it seems like maybe it's worth trading off some notion of where we've been in order to help either help ourselves or generally contribute to curbing the pandemic. But I've kind of ran it off on a monologue there. But I guess buried in there, there's some further questions about, you know, what are the ramifications in terms of percentage of deployment and or, you know, the privacy of information collected.
It's interesting to think about this because, I mean, one of the next steps that me and my colleagues would like to take is to look at the privacy and civil liberties implications of not just COVID tracing apps, but first of all, there's plenty of other technological centered approaches. For instance, there are governments around the world, including in liberal democracies, that are taking telecom location data and using it in this sort of effort. But also, you know, manual contact tracing is the practice of asking someone, where have you been? And actually, you know, as you said in the beginning, it's proven and it's effective, and people in the right context will help, will give up that information to varying degrees. Obviously, there's nuance in that. So, you know, it's interesting to think about that kind of thing. But, you know, so one of the big questions here, though, with regard to efficacy, though, is, so how do we, it gets back to the, how do we judge it, right? How do we judge whether or not, you know, this is effective? And I think that we're still figuring that out. There's so much more. So, you know, digital contact tracing apps in every context that I've come across are just a complement to manual contact tracing, never mind testing and social distancing and all that. There's so much more to go contextually than just these apps. Every technologist that I talk to, never mind all the epidemiologists that I talk to, are saying that, you know, these apps are complements. They're not the main thrust. They cannot be the main thrust. They can help, probably, but they're not going to be the main thrust. And so, you know, you got to put in resources to hiring human beings to do that manual effort.
I'm glad you mentioned that these are just one of the pillars of managing a pandemic. And this is not, even contact tracing is not an end-all be-all. But let's also talk about this issue of interoperability. Let's assume, you know, for the sake of argument, that the population, at least a significant amount of the population, a critical part of it, will download these apps, and that other things are also going and are in place, testing and so forth. What happens, because a lot of times, as you've already mentioned, there are government-backed, in other words, governments and public health officials are really backing the development and deployment of these solutions. So let's say you are in an area where there are multiple jurisdictions. You could potentially fall under multiple jurisdictions, and each jurisdiction may require a different app. How important is interoperability for these apps, and how do we, is there anything that can be done to ensure that it is interoperable?
So this actually speaks to what you asked before that I apologize, kind of failed to answer, which is kind of the technological hurdles to efficacy, right? What are the actual tech problems? So interoperability is an interesting problem because there's multiple levels of it. So you're talking about interjurisdictional, right? Which is super important, right? Can someone from France and someone from Germany, you know, are their phones going to be able to talk to each other and whatnot? At a very lower level, though, and, you know, also important level is, can my iPhone talk to someone's Android? And the answer for that, for most of the apps up until very recently, was no. And there were a lot of kind of, and that has to do with the operating system, the operating systems themselves, iOS and Android. And those are problems that Google and Apple can solve that app developers typically cannot, because of the way those operating systems govern Bluetooth. So Apple and Google came in. That was part of the API that they've recently introduced. And one of the fundamental and important things there is interoperability. Some of the other fundamental and important things there, if like sound very simple, but are actually have profound impacts on usability. For instance, if I'm using an iPhone and I don't have the app on the front, then the Bluetooth part of the system is not going to continuously function if it's not in the foreground. That's something that is just an Apple restriction on for security and privacy reasons that they can address and that they have addressed with their API. And so if you're using it, you can use that. Some of the other stuff I just wanted to address because you talked about before. So you mentioned, for instance, can apps talk? There are a lot of limits to what apps can do, like infected surfaces and things like that, you know, locations. That's something that is typically, so that's something that's, it's just as far as solution has been addressed by governments looking at location data. Now, some apps have been doing that. That's also been looked at by, when I talked about governments looking at telecom location data. So what they'll do is look at the, they'll essentially track their citizens in various forms. It may be on an individual level, it may be on an aggregate level. That varies from country to country, system to system. But what they do to try to do that is they say, okay, this supermarket had, 50 people, 30 of them have registered as, infected, the 50 people over the last 24 hours, and we can then therefore say that this is a very dangerous area, the services, looking at the facts and kind of using that. But also location data has its own problems. Location data and Bluetooth, which are, the big two, you can kind of divide the approach into those two ways, have their own problems. So location data, how do you get location data? Well, you might get it by GPS, but GPS is not like super precise. So I might pass by someone and GPS could miss that I've come into contact with someone. Bluetooth could do a false negative like that, could do a false positive print though. If I'm in an apartment and someone's behind a wall in the next apartment, Bluetooth could give me a positive. So there are a lot of tech issues here, without diving into, yeah. I've already diving into a billion, but without diving into too many more, there are a lot of potential tech problems, and not just potential, real tech problems that are going to come into play here. Does that mean that this stuff is totally useless? No. Does that mean that this is stuff that has to be taken into account, hopefully fixed, et cetera, et cetera? Yes. So there's a lot to think about there.
Are there any thought or any kind of plans to look at the, for example, the false positive rate of some of these apps? You mentioned Bluetooth and some of the vagaries of Bluetooth. In fact, I think the guys who invented Bluetooth were talking about this as a potential problem for contact tracing apps, some of the very things you mentioned. But that sort of brings up the issue of, false negatives and false positives and trying to understand, whether some of these apps, how well they do with those parameters, with those measurements.
Honestly, I wish I had a better answer for you here. I think this is just a major limitation of these apps here. They're going to get things wrong, right? Like, so I just mentioned the GPS thing. And at the end of the day, here's an even better one. So location, one of the ways they do location is triangulation. So three cell towers, that's how they find your phone. That's one of the way the governments have been tracking location. That's 3/4 of a mile precision. That's not very precise. Wow. So and these other things are more precise. Bluetooth is much smaller than that, but still has its own profound problems. There are going to be false positives. There are all going to be false negatives. And it just speaks to the fact that these apps have to be part of a larger system of, for lack of a better term, checks and balances. Human beings, I guess, would be actually the better way to put it, that can work on this with regard to testing and, seeing, okay, here's this positive that the app has flagged. Is that real? And that's the kind of thing that you need a human being to figure out.
Right.
So this is clearly an area that is in flux and that, even multiple different countries taking multiple different approaches, everybody's figuring it out for the first time. What are some of the things that you see happening now or on the horizon in terms of development of these apps and or use of them?
I think that this may be the naive optimist in me. I think there has been, in many cases, a move towards transparency here. And not just, transparency for the sake of transparency, if that has any meaning, but transparency because it's clear that trust is the key element to getting people to download these apps. And as we've discussed, people downloading these apps is key to effectiveness. So there have been apps that have been putting their code base out for review and audit and have been trying to be more clear on policies, privacy policies, terms of service, things like that. And so that's something positive. I mean, that's not across the board, but for instance, you know, India is something that I've been thinking about a lot for the past couple of months, and they've moved, I think, in the right direction as far as transparency goes in some of the ways that I just discussed, from an app that was a black box that you couldn't really tell what was going on inside to something that you have a much, much better idea now because it's open source and because there's much more information going on. However, I do think that overall, though, there is still like a profound transparency deficit here just in terms of technology overall. The apps, yes, but also just the technology in general, you know, how governments have been using location data, telecom data, beyond the apps. And that's in a way, I mean, we talk like, oh, are these apps voluntary or not? Well, the telecom data is not voluntary. Across the board, period, full stop. So, you know, with that in mind, maybe that's warranted, but we need more transparency in these various countries about how that's being approached, what the safeguards are, who can look at that data. We need to know more.
It's funny that you mentioned the transparency, because one of the things that you are tracking is this whole issue of destruction of the data. And I understand, as I understand it, this is after we've already used this data for the purposes for which it was intended, that this data not be used for other unintended purposes, right? So there are, of the 30 or so countries that are associated with some sort of an app effort, about a third, from what you track, say that their data destruction policies are still TBD. And about three countries, Mexico, Turkey, and Qatar, say they will not destroy the data. So they've come out and said it is their policy and they're not getting rid of the data. Did they offer up any reasons as to why? And why are so many of these policies still TBD?
I didn't talk to those three countries. I don't believe that they have offered why. So TBD is, when we approached this, we looked at all the nations back in the apps, and we reached out to all the companies and the government health authorities that are either building or affiliated with these apps. And we asked all the questions that we couldn't get. If let's say a lot of them have websites for these apps, and a lot of them answer some fundamental questions, but often there will be some big glaring questions left unanswered. So we reach out to them. And the truth is sometimes governments got back to us and sometimes they didn't. And for the sake, you know, in the context of this chart, database, as far as we figured it, TBD, which means they didn't get back to us, is effectively a no until we figure out otherwise. So, you know, the reason, but it's talked about data destruction in particular, it's interesting, you know, so we just talked about trust, right? Here are people giving over so much data, potentially, depending on the app, to the government. And people, a lot of experts recognize that building trust in order to build adoption is key here. But if you're just collecting a mass of data that has no expiration date, and another line here is no limitation that on who can access it. So you have this immortal data on where I've been, who I've talked to, that anyone can access, that has pretty profound implications for people's civil liberties. So, you know, that's something that we want to track, and that's something that we want people to know. This app does this with the data, or they won't tell us what it does with the data. I will say that the one app that you just mentioned that stuck out to my head was that in Turkey, if you test positive, that data goes right to the police. A lot of these apps do not, or at least say they won't share with law enforcement, and it won't be used for any purpose except for the health authority using it as they will.
Why police in their case?
To enforce the quarantine. So, which is not how it's being approached in the majority of the rest of the world.
Right. Well, that's Turkey is known to be increasingly more authoritarian as well. Yep.
Yes.
I think it's my moment to say that we need to find a more upbeat note to go out on.
I can give you an upbeat note, or maybe.
Yeah.
Oh, know? Please.
I think that there, so again, to go back to the 60% number, I think it's a really interesting number that says a lot about how we're thinking about this and thinking about the success of it. But at the end of the day, as far as I can tell, and as far as with the experts I talk to, digital contact tracing is here to stay. It's going to be here in the next disease outbreak. It's going to be a tool among many. It may get disproportionate amount of attention for various reasons that we could, I'm sure, dissect for hours versus manual tracing. But it's a new tool for public health authorities and a tool that can be effective and save lives potentially, you know, and the lessons we learn here. I mean, the reason the 60%, I think, is one important thing and all this stuff is important is because the lessons we learn here don't just inform what we do during coronavirus, but will inform how we attack the next disease outbreak, which is not, you know, an if, but a when. Obviously, as you said at the beginning, contact tracing, tried, true, proven for outbreaks for a long time now. And it's something that saves lives. And this is a new weapon in that arsenal. And that's both exciting, but also should provoke people to say, to question it and to say, okay, what are the risks? What are the benefits? How can we make this something that saves lives, but doesn't, you know, harm people unnecessarily?
I will. When you download the app, that you actually don't just leave it on your phone forever once this pandemic passes. Once it's done.
I just find it interesting that the two companies that people fear the most in terms of use of their private data were the ones who, Google and Apple, were the two stalwarts against privacy bashing features. Perhaps that's the positive note that you want to go out on, Leslie. She always wants to kind of end the episode on a positive note, and I tend to sort of drag it down into...
So thank you for that uplift, Alexa.
Well, I guess my last question is, what do you believe are the potential consequences, perhaps something that you can see now, of intended or unintended, of something like this, these contact tracing apps?
The potential consequences are pretty varied, right? I mean, one potential consequence is that it saves lives. Another potential consequence is that somewhere this data gets abused and results in some abusive authoritarian authority going over the line and hurting someone in whatever way. I think it varies so much. This database ranges from, you know, China, where good luck getting them to talk to you about anything like this sort of thing, to, you know, places like North Dakota, where, you know, they make certain choices that maybe not everyone agrees with exactly how it works, but they're being pretty transparent about their effort, and it's voluntary. So the point is there's so much variety in these apps that it's hard to say, like, here's going to be a consequence, here's not going to be a consequence. But it's an important moment, but it's part of, as I'm just going to repeat myself because it's so important when anyone tries to understand these apps, it's just one part of a much, much, much bigger system to fight the outbreak.
And indeed, fighting the outbreak and getting beyond this is something that we all want to do because... because we're all intimately familiar with the inside of our own houses now and would like to get back to the rest of the world. So I think we've learned a lot about the things to look for in terms of what a good contact tracing app looks like, at least in terms of, you know, would you like to download it and do your part? And a few things to look for to avoid, things to avoid in contact tracing apps. So very interesting discussion, and I want to say thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Patrick.
Thanks for listening to this TechSequences podcast.
We are Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. You can reach us by email, techsequences@techsequences.org. We'd love to hear from you to know what you thought about this episode or ideas for future episodes. Tech Sequences. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook and subscribe through your favorite podcasting service.